Thursday. Okay.
So if I leave it over there.
Next Wednesday and Thursday, as you all know, is Shavuos. So I'll just say a couple of words about Shavuos, a couple of interesting things that people might want to know before I get into the main body of the Shia. As I said the last couple of times, this is an informal Shia stroke discussion. If anybody has any questions during the Shia, feel free to ask. Just barge in or whatever. And then afterwards we can have some more general questions. I know Helen says she's got some questions. If anybody wants to ask questions on anything, hopefully I might be able to know some answers. Feel free to do so as well. And then we've got some refreshments to look forward to at the end. As you all know, Shavuos is synonymous with cheesecake, shall we say. Everybody knows that we have cheesecake, milky foods on Shavuos. But, but I just wanted to say a reason why we have milky foods, why we have cheesecake, why we have dairy products. So the main accepted reason given for having dairy products is as follows. On Shavuos, as we know, we got the Torah, we stood at Har Sinai, and we received the Ten Commandments and the rest of the laws. One of the main aspects of Judaism is dietary laws. As we know, certain animals we can eat, certain animals we can't eat. Even the animals that we can eat, we have a whole ritual slaughtering that must take place, and then we must sort of salt it so there's no blood, get rid of certain parts. So it takes a bit of time from when you want to eat an animal, you decide you want to shed it, till you can finally get it ready to prepare it for cooking. And obviously they had to learn all these laws. They just found out about them, took them time to learn them, practice the laws of Shechita, make sure they got it right. So therefore it took time to learn the laws of eating meat, and then obviously to get themselves skilled and know how to fulfill the mitzvahs concerning how to shech animals and how to shech meat. So therefore, because it was very difficult practically for them to sort of get meat, it was much simpler for them to have milky products and parrot products, because that was just easy. Could have milk and cheese, didn't need to have any special laws about that. So therefore, that is the main reason why we have milky foods, cheesecakes, or whatever you want to have on Shavuos, because they couldn't, or they didn't have time. It's a bit like Pesach, when they didn't have time for the bread to rise, so we have the matzah. So I suppose it's that idea. They didn't have time to prepare the meat because they didn't know all the laws of eating meat and the animals. So that is the reason why, the main reason given to why we have milky foods on Shavuos. Another reason given is as follows. Milk, as you know, is the sustainer of life. Babies for the first however many months or whatever it is of their lives, all they have is milk that contains all the nutrients that they need. And even so, milk is synonymous with calcium, which gives bones and gives you strength. Milk is very important for our diet. It can sustain, as we said, babies. That's the only thing they have. And that is the idea of the Torah. The Torah is meant to sustain us. It's supposed to be the only thing we need. So for that's the idea of milk and the Torah as well. That's more of a drush idea to explain it. And therefore, obviously, we have the practical reason that they didn't know the laws of eating meat and shechting and slaughtering. There's also another reason that milk and Torah is sort of connected. Milk sustains people, as we say, babies especially, that's all they have. And that's the idea that the Torah is supposed to sustain us, that's supposed to give us life. And that's another idea why we have milk, or don't have to have, but it's very important that one must still have meat and a bit of wine on Yom Tov, because the mitzvah to be happy on Yom Tov is with meat. So therefore one should still have meat. So there's different ways of doing it. Either have milk at night, meat during the day, or some people have milk first, because you don't need to wait 6 hours or 3 hours, whatever it is you wait after having milk. You can have it straight away, you clean your mouth or whatever it is, or wait half an hour. Some people have the minig, and therefore you can then have the meaty meal afterwards. But if you have the meaty meal first, then you have to wait a bit of time, 3 hours, whatever it is, till you have your cheese. So therefore, if you want to do both, you should have the milky meal, the cheesecake, and that side of things first. Another thing I'd like to talk about is the idea of flowers. And I saw something fascinatingly interesting that I wanted to share with you. I think you'll all enjoy. Most people know the reason why we have flowers, even though the price of them might be very expensive, is because Har Sinai, the mountain where we received the Torah, was full of flowers. Maybe that's unusual for a mountain in the desert to be covered in flowers, I don't know, but certainly it was miraculous. There was lots of flowers. It says quite clearly in the Midrash that there was lots of beautiful greeneries, from flowers and plants or whatever on Har Sinai. So to sort of replicate that, the shul is where we accept the Torah again. That is like our little Har Sinai, the Orem Kodesh. So therefore we adorn it with flowers. And I saw very interestingly brought down in the Mishnah Brura, he brings down that in the olden days, the minhag was that they had flowers and trees in their houses, as well as in the shuls. And then the Vilna Gaon, who lived in the time, he lived in the 1700s, the time of the Industrial Revolution. He was a very great Torah scholar, fantastic mind, and he wrote lots of books on halakha and things like that. He was an absolute genius. And the reason why I mentioned he was at the same time as the Industrial Revolution is because they say just like the Goyim had their sort of cleverness, their sort of chokhmah, their wisdom, which brought about the Industrial Revolution, so we also had great Talmid Chacham, great scholars like the Vilna Gaon. He was a genius, he knew things like that, and he used to spend hours a day learning. He was a very great man, and he decided, because obviously people at that time decided to have trees in the house for Xmas trees, he decided that therefore it's better to abandon the idea of having the trees in our houses, because people might think, oh, it's Xmas, and we're copying the Goyim of Xmas. So he abolished the idea of having trees in our houses on Shavuos. But in the olden days, there was a minhag to have trees in the houses for Shavuos. So I thought you'd all sort of like that. Pardon?
Get rid of our Christmas
tree. Well, that's another story for another share, perhaps. Another final thing I'd like to talk about Shavuos is the idea people know of staying up all night or staying up till daybreak to learn Torah, to study the Torah. And people, most people would know that the reason is the idea that the Jews, they overslept, if you like, on the time of receiving the Torah, and therefore to make up for the fact that they overslept. We stay up all night and we learn. It's a good idea anyway. We're about to receive the Torah, so therefore we learn, we prepare ourselves, and it's a good idea anyway. But the idea of staying up is supposed to be sort of like an atonement sort of thing for, not that it is an atonement, but for the sleeping in of the Jewish people at the time of the giving of the Torah. Which is a very strange thing to understand. How could they sleep in to receive the Torah? They must have been so excited. How could they possibly sleep in? Now, when we say sleeping in, the Torah was supposed to be given at daybreak. Now, in England, I don't know what it's like in the Sinai Desert, but daybreak is and sunrise can be, this time of the year, can be about 5 o'clock. So it is early. It's not like it's 8, 9, 10, 11 o'clock. They slept in all day. It was supposed to be early that they overslept. So the Aptarov, who was a very great Hasidic, one of the first Hasidic rebbes, and he decided to explain this in the following way. How could the Jews sleep in? So he said as follows. They were warned 3 days before Shavuos that they had to prepare for 3 days, or 4 days before they were warned 3 days. They couldn't touch their wives, they had to have extra special holiness, had to prepare themselves, they had to make themselves holy for 3 days. So he said, you can imagine, they were so excited from the beginning of the 3 days. Oh, we're getting the Torah soon, we're preparing, they must have been staying up all night, getting really excited, really enthusiastic. And then by the time it came to Har Sinai, they were just knackered. They'd used up all their energy being excited, and they'd hardly slept the 3 nights. By the time they got to Har Sinai, the time they got the night before the Torah, the humans, if you, you know, I remember when we were school, people used to say, oh, if you don't sleep for 3 days, you die. And I always think, no, you don't, you probably just fall off to sleep. But I presume that is correct, you'll fall off to sleep no matter where, even in the House of Commons, or in the middle of Barack Obama's speech, or whatever it might be, you'll just fall asleep. So they must have been so excited in the lead-up to Shavuos, we're about to receive the Torah, that they probably got so knackered and drained that they couldn't help themselves, they fell asleep. So that's where he explains this idea of why they overslept on Shavuos. So there's just a few things, obviously, that I'd like to mention about Shavuos. Now I want to speak in general, the main body of what I wanted to say about the Torah and Har Sinai. There is a very interesting question that maybe some of you have had as to why did we need to have this whole revelation at Mount Sinai? What was it there to achieve? Pardon?
So I've just going to ask.
Okay, well, here we go. Most of the Torah was transmitted to Moshe Rabbeinu. He went up for 40 days, he learned all the Torah. He came down and he taught the Torah to Aaron and the Kohanim and then to the rest of the Jews. That's clearly stated in Parshas Kisiso, where it says Moshe Rabbeinu came, V'diber el Aaron, he spoke to Aaron, clearly outnumbered in Kisiso just after the Egel. Then they went out, V'yotzo V'diber el Om, and then he spoke to the people. So they didn't hear all the Torah from Hashem, they heard the Ten Commandments, or even the Ten Commandments. Only two of them were by God because he couldn't cope with it. So Moshe said the rest. And the rest of the Torah was taught to Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe Rabbeinu transmitted it to the Jewish people. So why then did we need this whole big event? This huge Matan Torah, this revelation at Har Sinai, where they saw God himself and the voices and the shofar and everything. Why did we need to experience this great, awesome event? Why did we just have God telling Moshe, him then telling the rest of the Jews? And I'm going to mention this in strengthening the question, but this in itself will form part of the answer, so don't get too carried away. Just like with some of the other nations of the world, when they have their new revelations, like with Jesus or with Muhammad, they all claim, not that they had revelations at Har Sinai that thousands or millions of people saw, they all claim God came to them individually, an individual person, and they've gone away and they've taught the rest of their, whoever their followers might be, and therefore that's the way they've started their sort of new religions. So why did we need this huge, massive revelation of Har Sinai, where God himself came down? He doesn't come down every day. It's only this one time he came down and the mountain was burning. And if you read about it, as we'll read on the first day of Shavuos in the laning, no doubt acted out with all the noises, probably, depending on who's laning it. And it was such an awe-inspiring thing. What was the idea? What was the... Not that I can say what was the point of it, but how can we understand what was the idea, the rationale behind this whole revelation at Har Sinai?
Can I just ask a question? Is this the first or the second time that Moses brought the... certainly brought down the mountain?
You mean the actual tablets of gold?
Yeah, when brought them twice. When the people were waiting around the mountain, was that the second time? Because they had the golden calf the first time. So which time?
The second time was when he came down. The time you mean when he taught them the Torah was the second time he came down.
When they were waiting around the mountain, right.
Because the first time he came down, straight away he saw them serving
and
it again.
Straight away he smashed it,
and straight away he went back up to God.
Nice.
And he came down, and as soon as he came down the next day, he didn't get much rest. He was back up again with the new tablets. Right. So therefore, he didn't have time to tell the Jews the Torah. So you're right. He started telling the Torah after the second time he came down, which was on the day after Yom Kippur. So that's when he started teaching them the Torah. So, see that? It was the second time he came down, that's when he started telling them the Torah. So why do we have this whole revelation of Har Sinai? What's the rationale behind it? What is it meant to achieve, if you like? How are we supposed to understand why this occurrence happened? So I heard, or rather I read, in the name of Rabbi Miller, who is one of the teachers in the Gateshead Sem. So we've all heard of the Gateshead Sem. He is one of the big rabbis, and he, in one of his shiurim, in his transcripts, says the following. In the Torah, in Jewish law, if you want to, let's say, for instance, give somebody the death penalty for murder, then you need to have two people witnessing the crime. Those are the laws. Our people have to have two witnesses. But they've got to see the crime with their own eyes. So if I give you an example, you see somebody running with a gun after another person, and they both run into a locked room with no other doors out at all. And you hear him saying, "I'm going to kill you," boom, and you hear the big noise. And then you see him coming out with a smoking gun, and the DNA matches, all gunpowder burns all up his arms, as they can do these days. That is not enough to convict him for murder. God will deal with him, that's his business. But the Beth Din, they cannot give him the death penalty for such a crime, because you need to see it. Not only that, if I, one person, saw somebody running in, shooting him, so I saw the shooting in my own eyes, that's also not good. Why? A, because it's one person and you have to have two, and B, you have to warn him as well. So you have to say, "Excuse me, you can't shoot him. If you shoot him, you'll be liable for the death penalty." And he says, "No, I don't care," and he shoots him. Only then can you put him to death. You've got to have clarity, you've got to see it with your own eyes, not just circumstantial evidence, even if the evidence is so overwhelming, it's a locked room, there's nobody else could have shot him, there's no other possible outcome. Or maybe we can even say CCTV evidence. All these things are not good enough. You've got to have two people, they've got to see it with their own eyes, they've got to hear it with their own ears, and they've got to warn him as well.
and a high crime rate.
That doesn't mean God won't deal with them. That's between him and God.
But why do you think it's got to be two witnesses? Why isn't one? It would be a
If you look,
unless you think that he's insane and just on his own, you can't accept his.
Well, because when you have the two agents, they are questioned separately. So you take them out, and you ask them a whole series of difficult questions, and then you test the two answers together. Whereas if you have one person, he is much more. Well, it's much easier for him to make up a story and to get all the details right. But if you have two people, and you question them separately with difficult questions, not in front of each other, then you're much more like. And obviously, if you have any discrepancies, then you can sort of say, right, you've got discrepancies. That might not mean it didn't take place. But you can't convict him if there are any discrepancies in the stories. If he said it was a, I don't know, he was wearing a red T-shirt, and the other guy said he was wearing a blue T-shirt, that's what's called a discrepancy, and you can't give him the death penalty. It's got to be exactly equal and matching. So much so that the government says they only killed approximately, not just for murder, for any capital punishment, approximately once every 7 years, and another person says it was only once every 70 years, because the getting the death penalty, you need to have such clear evidence. I mean, you see lots of stories where people are convicted, and then they found out that the evidence was rubbish. Or maybe that's only in films, I don't know. But you need to have, in Judaism, clarity. You've got to see it, two people, they've got to warn him, and that's the only way that the Beth Din can convict him and put him to death.
You often read or hear that two witnesses can see it exactly the same event, and both of them will describe different things about it.
They might do.
Say different things about it.
They might do. What's even more of an interesting question, if you have two brothers, even Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron, who are the most trustworthy people, but because they are two brothers, they cannot testify together.
Right.
Because those are the laws. That's what God decided. Even though you have Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron, you can't accuse them in any way of lying or whatever, but those are the rules. So, we can get the idea that in Judaism you need to have crystal clear visual evidence. That is the way the laws work. So, as we all know, the Torah is emet, the Torah is true, and there are no contradictions in the Torah. As we say on Shabbos morning, Torah Hashem Tamimo, the Torah Hashem Tamimo, it's perfect. What do you mean it's perfect? It's perfect, I mean there's no contradictions. Yes, there are things you don't understand, and the things that need explaining, but you don't have somewhere which is totally the opposite of something else. It all makes sense. You've got all the Gemaras and all the Mishnayos and all these things. Nothing sort of in the Torah contradicts itself. There's difficulties and you have to explain things in different ways, but it's Tomim, it's perfect. There's no sort of things that are not true, things that are lies, or things that sort of goes in one place totally opposite to another place. It's perfect. Absolutely perfect. So we know those are the laws, and therefore if God wanted the Jews to accept the Torah, and in his Torah that he's about to give, he's about to tell them, I'm afraid, when it comes to evidence, you need crystal clear evidence, you need visual evidence, you need two people, you need to have it clear and to be warned. He has got to play by the same rules. Because otherwise you could accuse him of being a hypocrite. What was this? You taught the Torah to Moshe? How do we know? You tell Moshe in his Torah that if we want to convict somebody, you need two people to see it. You've got to warn them. And here you're coming with Moshe Rabbeinu telling us the whole Torah. How can it be? So in order to preserve the tamimus, the perfection of the Torah, God had to allow the Jews to see him, to perceive him, whatever that means, whatever form that was. Because otherwise, you would have said, excuse me. The Torah says you need crystal clear evidence, you need to see it, you need to visualize it, you need to be warned. They were warned in 3 days, 4 days time, I'm coming, I'm going to come down on this mountain and give you the Torah. So they were warned about it, they knew it was going to happen. And they saw it with their own eyes. Because if that's what the Torah demands of you as a person, if that's what the Torah demands of us as a nation, then that Torah God has to play by the same rules. And therefore he had to come down, he had to make himself known to the people. He had to let them see him, perceive him, whatever that means, hear his voice, in order that there would be crystal clear clarity, crystal clear knowledge that God, A, exists, and B, commanded us to keep the Torah. Now, I also mentioned before, when I asked the question, and I said this bit, extra bit of the question also gives a bit of the answer, where we talk about Muhammad or Jesus or these, whoever other religions it might be, who claim to have it on their own, they don't have this. They don't, because you cannot tell people, I cannot turn around to all of you in this room and say, you were all there yesterday, at such and such a place, because you said, I didn't hear it, I wasn't there. I can say, I was yesterday, and God came to me, and he told me X, Y, and Z. You can believe me, if you want. I'm not saying it did happen, but you could believe me, because, yeah, maybe he was there. Yeah, maybe that's what happened. But you can't convince somebody that you were there, if you weren't there. I can't say, you all there, do you not remember? It's not like the men in black, where they zap you, and you forget about it, or whatever it might be. You can't trick people you weren't there. And that's perhaps why, and this again, following this year, it's not my own sort of fact saying this, maybe these people like Jesus and Muhammad and these other prophets who tried to start their own things did not come out with a huge idea of some sort of public revelation or some sort of big master miracle, because they knew, well, we can't sort of, you know, get that across, because that would just be too unbelievable. You can't say to people, you were there, you saw the revelation. No, we didn't. What are you talking about? So they have to go down the route. Yes, God came to me and he wants me to tell the people, blah, 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 and the rest of it. But that's why God came at Mount Sinai. And it's funny, because that seems to be accepted. I mean, I've now been doing a bit of research on Methodists, because the Methodist conference is coming, so I've been reading up a lot and talking to a lot of people. And they believe, and this was a bit of a... I suppose I should have realised this, but I never really quite got to the point of this about Christianity and whatever, that yes, they also believe in the revelation of Mount Sinai. They believe that took place. And they believe in everything that occurs in the Torah with the exodus of Egypt and the conquering of the land of Israel. I suppose I thought of this, but I never really appreciated what they believed in. But they believe when it came to Jesus, all that continuation went through him and the Christians through there. But even they believe, I mean, I don't know what the Muslims and Muhammad believe in, because I've not gone into that. Maybe next time they have a conference here, perhaps we'll delve into it. But that's what they believe, that they are the continuation of the revelation, Yetzias Mitzrayim, the exodus of Egypt. They believe, yes, it all happened, it was all true, and that's just continued through them. The Jews lost their rights, just I suppose like the firstborns lost their right to the Levites. They said the Jews lost their rights to us, and therefore they continued on their path. But they still very much believe in the revelation of Mount Sinai, the coming down of God onto the mountain and everything, and that's what they believe in, which was a bit of a... Well, I suppose I never really thought about it too much. I've been trying to concentrate on my own religion, which is thought-provoking and difficult enough. But that was something that sort of was made an impression with. That's what they believe. So even the Christians, who've gone their own separate ways, do we get to ask you a question? Even they believe in the revelation of Mount Sinai, they don't argue with its validity. They try and change it, and we'll go our own separate ways later. But they do not question the validity of Hasina, because to say such a huge event took place and there were millions or thousands or however many people were there watching it, you can't make up such a thing. You can't fool people into believing they were there. Like in the Torah, you were there. No, we weren't there. What are you talking about? So obviously they were there, because you wouldn't, as I've seen in previous generations that people try to start their religion, they don't make up such a story, because to make up such a story would be unbelievable. So therefore that is the reason why HaKadosh Baruch Hu God made this great revelation, to prove to us. Obviously, it says quite clearly, in order that you see all these great fires and noises and voices to scare you, to frighten you into believing in God and into following his commandments. So now we've got a bit of better understanding why God had to make this huge revelation of Mount Sinai, and not just why he made this huge revelation, but what we are supposed to take out of this revelation. What is it there to teach us? Obviously, the ideas of the Torah we have to learn and study, but the actual act, the moment, the day of Mount Sinai, the day of the Torah, is supposed to teach us this. This is not a joke. Torah is emes. I want to go on to diverge slightly further and talk about the emes, the validity of the Torah and certain things. And I believe we've got a lot of things that you might find very interesting for part two. But that's the thing we can take away for the moment. That is what it is supposed to teach us.
Well, before you leave this particular spot, why Sinai? I mean, we don't... It's not one of our major holy sites, is it? Not really.
No, it's not a holy site. And indeed, it's not specifically supposed to be a holy site to teach you that the Torah can be acquired by everybody, or shall I say anybody, anywhere, anytime, any place. It's not... I mean, it's the same with the shul. And I say this to the schools that come round and they teach you, because the Christians, the whole church is their whole focal point. A shul, a base knesses, is not a holy word. Knesses is gathering, like the Knesset, where they have their parliament. That's all it means, a place of gathering. We can have a minion here tonight in this house. It doesn't have to be a shul or anything like that. The focal point in Judaism is not places of worship, it's not shuls, it's not... Obviously the Beis HaMikdash was the focal point, and when that was destroyed, so we have to try and replicate that idea where you come together and to be inspired. But the focus of Judaism is the Torah of us. That can be done anywhere, any place. And another idea, just while we're on this topic, Sinai is supposed to be one of the smallest mountains in the region, to teach you that people who want to really learn the Torah and accept the Torah should be lowly people. Necessarily that they're low in what they know, and not because people can still be very clever and very important people, but they should think themselves as low. We're not boasting, we're not getting carried away, we're humble. It was like a small mountain, a humble mountain, surrounded by all these huge, sort of huge, other massive mountains at the time. I don't think anybody exactly knows or officially can prove exactly. I mean, people have ideas where our Sinai is, but again, we don't know exactly. But otherwise, maybe people will turn it into a shrine. Maybe people would, you know, turn it into a sort of, you know. But that's not the idea of it. The mountain where it was given, that's not really important. The idea of it was given. We have the Torah, and that's what we take. Not because sometimes people get carried away with the moment and the place, and oh, this place is holy, and go here, and yes, 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 yes. But that's not really the main. Yes, there are certain holy sites and Jews and people go to, and they have certain elements of Kedusha we can still attain, but that's not the aim of Jewish life. The Jewish life is you can take it anywhere, everywhere. It's you, it's the Torah, it's not specific to places. So that's one of the ideas why we don't know where our Sinai is. It's not really talked about, we don't know, and that's sort of the idea behind that.
Can I come in here, but will you take a breath? I couldn't get in. Two points. First of all, I met somebody yesterday, a Christian man, in a group of people, and he was talking about, I don't know how it started this conversation, that he went to Sinai with his wife. They went for a month backpacking, and they went up to Mount Sinai, and I said, well, where is Mount Sinai? And he said, well, it's a range of mountains. We don't know exactly. I said, where was Moses? Where did Moses die? He said, I don't know. It's a range of mountains. Fine. And when they got to the top near St. Catherine's Monastery or something, he said, it's a little hut and it's full of graffiti. And I said, well, it's like that on most places at the top. And then he said something about that belongs to Israel. And I said, what do you mean? He said, and Jordan belongs to Israel as well. So I said, all right, get closer to this guy, you know. I said, what makes you say that? Are you a Christian? He said, yes. I said, well, what stream do you belong to? Are you Christians, was it the Christian Association for Israel? He says, no, he said, we're Methodists. Which is where you started about being supporters of the revelations you were telling us just now, and Sinai. So it's all coming together, so it's obviously true.
I'm not arguing.
No, I was really surprised, and you just sort of confirmed it.
Yeah. Well, Santa Catarina is not Mount Sinai, it's where Jabal Musa. It's Jabal Musa. It's a Jabal is like a little hillock, but they call it Jabal Musa. It's nothing to do with Judaism at all.
No,
it's a monastery for.
It's in a valley. Cistercian
monks.
You were losing the points, line. Yeah.
Could I ask something?
Yes.
What actually did Moses bring down? You talk about the Torah. The five books of Moses is a historical product. So all these rules, did he bring down the dietary laws? Did he bring down laws relating to...
He brought them down in his head and he transmitted them over. That's what he was doing for 40 days.
Because 40 days and 40 nights.
He was getting taught all the various laws.
That was the Torah Shebe'al Peh.
But the main thing was the Ten Commandments.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about the main thing. Because in Judaism, it's not that. The main thing is like the Gemara, the Talmud, the explanations. And I saw, when I was doing research for the Shia, I can't remember who it said. It said one of the main ideas you can understand why the Talmud and the Mishnah is most important. Because even the non-Jews, the Christians, they all read all the Bible and the Tanakh and all these things. But that's very easily accessible. But nobody, well, and nowadays maybe people do. Where was it? These people in South Korea. was it you were telling me? Well, within the Jewish Chronicle, these people in South Korea studying the Torah to become clever and become doctors and all that. Oh, you were telling me, wasn't it? That's right, it was you. So maybe that's not a good example, but the idea is that is what, when you talk about the Torah, when you talk about the Torah, all the, and I'm not even going into Kabbalistic things or Bible codes, any of that sort of stuff, just when you talk about the Torah and learn it, you're mainly referring to, as she says, the Torah Shebaal Peh, the, what is supposed to be the unwritten law, not unwritten in the sense of Parliament has unwritten laws, but it's not, it was supposed to be transmitted through mouth, from generation, the oral law, that's the word I was looking for, although nowadays it is written down because people are starting to forget it, but that is mainly when we refer to Torah, that is mainly what we were referring to, because to learn the Tanakh without anything else is very confusing, because you wouldn't know what's going on. You'd have Shavuos every year on a Sunday, because it says, Mimochras HaShabbos, the day after Shabbos, you start counting the 50 days, which means every year that Shavuos will be a Sunday and Monday. So therefore, we don't have it that way, because it turns out that Shabbos, they bring various proofs that Shabbos refers to Yom Tov as well, so they're talking about the day after the first day of Pesach, so therefore, that's how we do it. Now, just while he's on this point, it's probably a good time to say that most of the times when they're bringing proofs to certain things, it's working backwards. What I mean by backwards is, it's not saying, oh, this looks like this, so therefore we learn now this. It's the other way around. We know that this law is true because God transmitted it and Moshe taught it, and we know that this law exists. So how can we see it? Where can we see this law hinted at or mentioned in the Torah? So that's when you talk about we prove a certain law by seeing whatever. It's always working backwards. The laws are there, we know them, because that was transmitted to Moshe on the mountain, and he came down and transmitted it to the Jewish people. And therefore, a lot of the time, the Gemara of the Talmud is looking at what parts of the Torah, where do we learn it out, little letters, little words, connections of things. For instance, Shabbos is mentioned next to it, says don't build the Mishkan on Shabbos. So we can say, ah, that means doing things in building the Mishkan are forbidden on Shabbos. So all that's how we learn out. But it's not that way round. We know certain things are forbidden on Shabbos, carrying, writing, and all that sort of stuff. Where can we see it? Because it's not mentioned clearly. Ah, we can see it because it's mentioned next to the temple. But it's that way round. It's not the other way round. Saying, oh, right, I see the connection of this. Let's make up a new law because this seems that you can't do that. Because it's all what we know from Moshe.
So that all came from God, did it?
Indeed.
Because a lot of things hadn't happened. But the laws are there.
But the dietary
That's
laws...
That's why I don't understand you.
Yeah, but the dietary laws are not dependent on history. The laws of Tefillin or Mezuzah or Shabbos... Or, the,
or marriage not, and things like that.
I mean, they're not dependent on history.
You know, it's incredible that the ideas are there. Where did it come from, God? You know, yes. Something has come from.
Well, you talk about that. One of the proofs that people bring when they talk about the Torah being true is, if you read it, people have studied the Torah and the Gemara and the Talmud and the Mishnah and all the maybe hundreds of thousands of commentaries and books and things that are written on the Talmud and the thought processes behind it and the way everything makes sense. And then even if you go further into Kabbalistic things and Bible codes and all sorts of other things, that people are interested in nowadays, if you add up all of that together, these things can't just be made up by man. It's very difficult for a person to come up with a book, even Harry Potter, which is one of the most... But you can't write a whole sort of Rashi and Tosfos and books and all sorts on Harry Potter, and then Harry Potter codes, and all... You couldn't do it, because it's not... You know, so that's one of the proofs that they bring, that all the Torah is must have been by God. Because if you read it and you appreciate it, and the more you learn it, the more you appreciate how amazing it actually is. And that's what I want to talk about in part two.
Are the codes valid?
Well, whether people who make them are the correct... There is a thing of codes, yes. Whether people themselves have got the right codes is another story. But there is a thing of codes and letters. That's why certain words are spelled with a vav and certain words are spelled without a vav or whatever. Like last week, Cedra, every tribe was counted. And the words for counted was Shemos, the names. Half the time it's written with a vav and half the time it's written without a vav. Because it's all to do with codes and who knows what. So there is definitely an idea of Kabbalistic ideas. The whole Sfiras HaOmer is full of Kabbalistic ideas. Whether it's the Kabbalistic that Madonna goes to with all these funny things, or this Bible codes book that I've got in the South Port Shul that was written by a non-Jew in the library there, whether that's what it is another story. But there is an idea of Bible codes, definitely. That's no question about that. As Alex Ferguson would say.
Did the rabbis that you have there, and continuing from there up in the Galilee, make all these new laws? Was that the Mishnah that they composed?
Well, they didn't make laws.
I mean, when they
collated them and they wrote them down, Rabbi Yehuda had nothing. Yes.
Yeah, well, they're sort of.
It's the interpretation of them.
But a lot, exactly, a lot of things have grown, such as on Shabbos, for instance, they made new laws, not that they're laws of the Bible, but they made rabbinical restrictions.
Yeah.
Lots of rabbinical restrictions, or lots of them. So those were obviously formulated over time. Like in the story of Megillas Rus, which we're going to read on Shavuos, where the woman sat next to him in the bed, which nowadays is forbidden. That those laws of not being with a woman who's not your wife, locked up in a room, that law only came in afterwards. That's not a law in the Bible, that's the laws the rabbi said. But at the time of Boaz, when he was in the barns, they didn't have those laws yet, which is why Rus could go sleep next to him.
Was it better?
Right, okay, have we got any other questions?
Can I just say, I don't know what the time scale was, but just previously the children of Israel were frustrated, were unhappy, were building idols, were building golden calves. Were those stones brought down specifically to change the attitude and behaviour, or was this to go to the world and all religions initially?
I don't think it was meant to be for all religions, because that would reduce the idea that the Jews are the chosen people and special. The Torah was meant for us. If you look, the rabbis say the Torah was offered to other nations. So I think definitely it was meant for us, for our people. I think that is definitely so.
Right. But it was a method to cool them down, to bring a bit of discipline, to bring...
Well, you say that, but the golden calf came after they got the tablets.
Did they? Yeah. After that, that's why I was asking about the time scale.
People can do all sorts of things, people can slip, but definitely it was designed, obviously, to teach them the correct path. And it was meant to, as I've said many times from the pulpit, a lot of people perceive Judaism as being a religion of can'ts and can't-dos, and maybe a sad religion, but nothing can be further from what it's meant to be. It's meant to be to enhance your life. There was one person said to a friend of mine, "Oh, you Jews, always off work, festivals and Shabbos." He said, "Yes, it's all so easy, and you're always drinking and boozing, whatever." Well, I don't know about Friday nights on the town, if you can say that we're any boozing compared to them. But we'll talk about boozing shortly, as it happens.
It's an interesting subject.
Yes.
Right.
Well, I'm going to mention boozing shortly. Next part of the show, I want to move on to give what I think you'll all find very interesting. Things that are mentioned in the Torah from thousands of years ago that are coming true now, and people can perceive, because we know the Torah is emes, it's true, it's correct. Lots of things we can perceive nowadays as being true. And there's a fascinating Mishnah in Sotah, chapter 9. It's the last Mishnah, it's huge. Mishnah 15. And it describes what the world would look like at the time of Moshiach. And it gives 10 things, and I think you'll find it fascinatingly interesting. But just before I start this Mishnah, there are lots of prophecies as well that were mentioned at the time, thousands of years ago. People might have thought a bit weird. But nowadays one can understand them and perceive them. For instance, classic example given nowadays, talks about in the war of Gog and Magog, when it final war, whatever that means, it will take 7 months to bury the dead, so many dead people. Wipe out, and talks about wiping out all the Arabs in 15 seconds or whatever it is, just like that. Maybe those days people couldn't understand, couldn't get a visual idea what such a thing could be. But nowadays, with things like nuclear weapons, we can perceive you can wipe millions, maybe even billions of people out, just like that, with a little press of a button, boom. It's another idea. In fact, whether this is the fulfillment of the prophecy or not, I don't know. Apparently, at ground zero, the last person was buried. Bits of body were buried, and they got them out of the rubble 7 months after the Twin Towers fell. That is a story brought down in many Jewish articles. Over 7 months, they'd caused huge buildings, so much rubble, even though there wasn't that. Okay, I'm not trying to condone the loss of life, don't get me wrong, but when you think about 7 months to bury the dead, I think of millions and billions of people. but in the Twin Towers only a few thousand people, but because of so much rubble, two huge towers of massive proportions, it took so long physically for them to dig them out. So you can see ways that these prophecies, we don't know if these are the fulfillment of the prophecies, and obviously the Holocaust, certain people say, certainly fulfills many of the terrible things. Many people, oh, how could it be? And then unfortunately we see what happened to the Holocaust. We can see ways that these things have been fulfilled. When it talks about we'll go back to Israel on eagle's wings, could now perhaps mean aeroplanes, and all sorts of things like that. We talk about God listening to everything we say, God writing everything we say, and people in the olden days might not have had any perception what it means. God is listening, he's writing things down. But of course, nowadays, look at me, I'm recording this here, and I can listen to it anytime I want, send it around the world. We can perceive these ideas, whereas thousands of years ago, well, 2448 they received the Torah, so 3,000 years ago, they couldn't perceive these ideas. They believed that the Torah is Emes, but they couldn't necessarily have an idea of how to understand it. We can have more of an understanding nowadays. And that's why I think when it says Moshiach will come on a donkey, the idea being not a big, huge horse or animal, be a humble man, doesn't necessarily mean he might be riding physically on a donkey. He might not be driving a Mercedes or a Lexus. He might be driving a Ford or a Vauxhall, as I see outlined in the driveway. So we can understand ideas. Another idea, for instance, that we can use to understand... Oh, that's what I was going to say. It talks about when Eliyahu HaNavi, the prophet, announces the arrival of Moshiach, he will stand on Har HaZeis in the Mount of Olives, and his voice will be heard from one end of the world to the other end of the world. Now, this could be television, could be internet, could be you've got a very low voice, could be you can hardly hear him. But you stick a microphone and a TV camera, and it goes around the internet, Twitter and Facebook and all the other media outlets, and the whole world could be seeing it at the time, even though the voice is not very loud. So you can perceive nowadays things that are mentioned, things thousands of years ago, we can perceive them. So much so is this Mishnah, which was made the time of the Mishnais, the time of the Tanoim, finished in the year approximately 70 Common Era, 70 years after, is it the birth or the death? I'm never quite sure which. Whatever. Anyway, so we're talking about just under 2,000 years ago, this Mishnah was written down, it might have been said earlier. And I think you'll find this fascinating. I brought along an English translation because I wanted to read the English translation. Not that I didn't think you'd trust my translation, but I think it makes more of an impression. If I read that in English, I think it always makes an impression on people when they can actually see or hear it from the English rather than just me sort of translating it. Okay. The only problem is the Hebrew is here and the English is over there. Anyway. Be'ikvasa de Moshiach. In the heels of Moshiach, literally translated, in the time that Moshiach is about to come, which we hope is very much now. And it's going to list 10 things that will be prevalent at the time of Moshiach. This mission was made 2,000 years ago, and you'll see, I don't need to explain, you'll see these things are all occurring nowadays. And it's an idea to prove the validity of the Torah, the fact that the Torah is true and emes, and I think you'll all appreciate it. So the first thing it says, Chutzpah Yaske, which here he translates as Chutzpah, we all know what Chutzpah is, will be very prevalent. That's the first thing. Everybody will be chutzpahing, cheeky. We can see that nowadays. People are very cheeky, have no respect. Chutzpah. Even things like claiming expenses. It's a chutzpah thing. It's thinking that you think you get away with it. That's all the idea contained in chutzpah. You know, people try and get away with as much as they can, try and cheat. That's the idea of chutzpah, not just literally saying something, a bad word or a clever comment. It's the old idea of how people live their lives in a chutzpahic way, try and get away with as much as they can. The next thing, the Yoker Yamir. The vine, produce shall soar its costly. And we see nowadays, with inflation 5% or a few weeks ago, whatever it was, the price of vegetables has gone through the roof. We can see the price of produce shall soar in costliness. Produce, food, fruit and vegetables. You all do, the ladies do the shopping. You can all tell me that the price of fruit and vegetables, I know now because I buy my own for my flat, that the price of fruit and vegetables has gone through the roof. Astronomically so.
What book is that?
This is the Mishnayos in Sotah, which is the third section of Mishnayos, chapter 9, Mishnah 15. It's a huge, long Mishnah that goes on for about 3 pages, but it's somewhere in the middle.
Does it mention the year 6,000?
No. No, it doesn't mention any particular year, otherwise it'd be easy, wouldn't it? But, right, so we can see these things are coming true. Hagefentit imperio, vahayain be yoker. Wine will be very expensive. It is nowadays, you go wine expensive. But boozing will be on the rise. And you see that nowadays, despite the price of wine. That wine will be very expensive, but people will still get drunk. Even the fact that the wine is very expensive, drunkenness will be on the increase. We see it nowadays. You only need to have a look. Not that I have. At Southport, well, I used to see Saturday night when I used to go home in the winter. That's my excuse. And used to see, even though wine is expensive, they keep saying, oh, minimum pricing. Well, I don't think any of that's
talking about the going or us.
Well, this is talking about generally the whole world nowadays. There are certain things that you'll see apply to Jews. But this is talking about the whole world and prevalent as well as Jews. We can say wine is very expensive. You try to buy a bottle of Kiddush wine, it costs, you know. But drunkenness and boozing is on the increase. Right. Whatever reason you want to give.
It's on the increase, but it's not prohibited.
Mustn't forget.
Doesn't say anything about prohibited. It's talking about wine will be expensive, yet drunkenness will be increased. Yoke, it will increase.
We mustn't forget that in the days of Noah, he became drunk.
He did indeed, but he had a good reason. He finally got out of the table from here.
There's always a reason.
Yes, well, yes, he did. He did got drunk, yes.
They got him drunk.
And non-Jews, literally, what does it translate here? The heathen shall be converted to heresy. Which basically means that we're a secular society. People, and it goes on to say, a few more examples later on, about how people who believe in God are criticized. We can see very secular society. There was a report out a few months ago, I remember, that Britain is now becoming a very secular society. There were figures, I can't remember what they were. Secularisation, people who believe in God, that's another one of the things later. People who believe in God are laughed at. You can see that happening nowadays. World is a very secular place on the whole. The Einter Kochon, there's no rebuke. Nobody listens to rebuke. Nobody listens to being told off. Kids, nobody. Look at the kids in the schools, the teachers, try to tell you off. They accuse the teacher, oh, he hit me, he touched me, oh, coming and getting sacked and then abuse and assault and all that old nonsense. Ain't a cock, there's no discipline. There's no rule of order. Base Vard Yilas North, this is the interesting one. The house of the Chachomim, the shuls and the yeshivas will be turned into a house of Zanus. into a house of adultery. I'm not aware myself of any examples of this. Well, as it says here, into adultery.
Prostitution is different from adultery.
Don't get thinking when I get up to it, to that flat. I hope you're not wishing things on me.
I'm just thinking.
Well, maybe, as we say in talking about nations, you hear stories with the clergy, members of the clergy, yes, and things like that. Yes. That's a base fad, that's a non-Jewish place of worship, and they get up to all sorts of things there. So these are things you can see that happening nowadays. And these two areas, the Galilee and the Gavlon, not exactly sure which area that is even here. It says it doesn't know exactly what areas. They shall be desolate. These areas shall be a few of people. The Galilee, the area of the Golan, what's known of the Galilee by the Golan Heights area there, all that place.
Northern Israel.
Mm-hmm. I don't know exact figures how many people living there, certainly Jews, whatever. That's what it says here. And the people of the borders, here it gives a different word, the rabbis, we won't exactly go into this, the rabbis will go down from town to town and nobody will have mercy on them. Now, this is my interpretation of this particular point. You open the Jewish Chronicle most weeks, yes. And you see rabbis, yes. You told me the story of rabbis getting sent to court, and taken to task, and nobody has mercy on them, they go to a different place. Anyway, we can see these things are happening, whatever they mean. The Chochma Sofrim Tisarach, and the Chochma, the genius of the Chachomim, the wise men, Tisarach, it will stop to smell, it will go off, it won't be as sharp, the people won't be as clever in Torah, certainly, as certainly they used to be in the olden days. The Yirei Chet Yimosu, and those who are God-fearing and people who fear have the fear sin Yimosu, they'll just be sort of, what's the word it uses here? They shall be loathsome. People will laugh at them. You know, people who, God-fearing people, look at him. Oh, what do you think he is? What do you think he's doing? Oh, what's he? They can see these things happening nowadays. Now, these next bits you could certainly see happening for MS Tehene Deres, and the truth shall go wandering. People don't tell the truth nowadays, all lies getting out of it. And, oh, it's not quite lies, we're being, what's the word everybody uses? No, there's another word with the truth, we're being,
economical.
Oh, we're being economical with the truth. People, the truth has gone wandering, it's gone off, it's gone on holiday. The truth is very much sort of not told in most sort of...
Serving wasn't that good at the time of the miracles. And when people saw miracles happening, they weren't that well behaved.
Maybe not quite as bad as this. Well, have a listen to these next ones. I don't think these next ones happened in previous generations so much. The next ones are certainly applicable nowadays. Na'orim b'nei zekenin yalbinu, the children, to the faces of the elders, they will mock. They will mock the elders, no respect for elders or for authorities, especially nowadays with the technological age. So therefore all the kids know much more than their parents because they know how to do all the internet and they know how to do all the gadgets and their parents don't. So they look at the parents of the old generation as old-fashioned and as outdated and useless and awful. Oh, you're old-fashioned. That's how people are viewed. The Canaan Yamdim Neketani, the old people would rise before the youngsters. In other words, things are opposite way around. Nobody has respect for the elders. In fact, the elders are all scared of the children. They would have to bow down, as it were, to the youngsters. Bain Manavel of a son. I'll translate it here exactly how it says here. The son will dishonor the father. Bas Koma Ba'ima, the daughter will rise up against her mother. Kala Bachamosa, a daughter-in-law with a mother-in-law, so each person's household will be his enemies. All days, your house was your fortress, you were certainly the man, was the boss of the family. They'll turn into his enemies. And we can see nowadays how these things, and we can see people have no respect for the elders, people don't respect authority, anything like this. Pnei ha-dog and pnei ha-kelef. The face of the generation will be like the face of a dog. What exactly this means, I don't know. I don't know if anybody's signs of their country, their flags, maybe or dog. I don't know exactly what that means, but these are the things.
Any good news coming?
Yes, the good news is that when all these things are happening, Moshiach is round the corner. The good news. Pardon?
Within the year 6000.
Well, that's still a long time, technically. If we're in the year 5771, you've still got... tomorrow or today, you know. Don't want to wait 300 years. So, and the last one is... Habein Einoi Mispayish Me'aviv. A son won't be embarrassed from his father. Almi Eshlon Lehishon. Who can we rely on? As you say, it's so terrible. What hope is there? Alavina Shemashomayim. We have to hope and pray to the Lord, Father in Heaven. So I think... that this is basically, nowadays, we can see the fulfillment, certainly, of these things that were written 2,000 years ago about the time of Moshiach. We can see it. We can appreciate it. It's here. It's happening in front of our eyes that the Torah is emes. It's true. It's just. It's not lies. It's not jokes. We can understand so much of the prophecies, so much of the ideas expressed that even thousands of years ago, they wouldn't... We will go eagle's wings, they would have thought we'll sit on eagles or whatever. They wouldn't have appreciated what it means. They believed it was true, but they didn't have an appreciation. Nowadays we have so much appreciation with technology, with facts. We can see these things that the Mishnah brought down are coming true. Genius, we can see all these things as you appreciated, you all heard, and I'm sure you all agreed that most of these things are all coming true nowadays, and that just goes to prove. A, that we hope Moshiach is literally round the corner. There was a great rabbi who said, who's very, very ill, Rabbi Koppelman. I went to him recently for a bracha. He's 105. I met him also once in a Lutz survey. Old man who's over here at the moment came to Manchester about 4 months ago, and he said in his speech, Moshiach is very imminent. He said, not a matter of years, a matter of months. But again, just like as I say, it's a wedding. When people put down the chuppah, we'll start at 3 o'clock. And people say, it's like, what do you mean the chuppah? And I say, most people, does it mean literally you're standing under the chuppah? Is it the start of the procession to the walk to the chuppah? Nobody knows. So that's why in my invitations I want to put a prox. Because I don't believe people put prox, and that's what you talk about the truth going walkies. Ah, I'd like to put a prox. Or I don't even put chuppah, I put time of beginning of Kaponos Ponim, and then the chuppah is whenever it follows, but I don't think people who are quite accurate with that sort of thing. But anyway, maybe we can bring the truth back from its wanderings. But you can see an appreciation. So why did I bring that in about weddings? That's right. Because when it says Moshiach is coming, presumably it means that we can actually see him physically here with the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Or it could, who knows what exactly it means. Moshiach times, we can see these things are certainly happening. And when it talks about Be'ikvasa, as I said, literally, Ikvasa means the heels, which refers to the very last bit, the bottom bit, the very end, you've got from the head to the bottom, the very last bits of Moshiach, like you have in the parasha Ekev Tishmon. If you listen to the ones that people normally crush with their heels, the little insignificant mitzvahs, you'll get all these great rewards. The idea of the heel, it's the very bottom, right at the end of the body, you've only got up to the toes. And as we can see, all these things are happening nowadays, so hopefully we're way, way down the foot. Let's hope it's only a small shoe size, and we don't have long to wait. But I think I wanted to bring out the idea that we can see, there's so many more examples I could have given, of how we can see that things that are written, that were written years ago. Another example, I did toy with the idea of explaining this, but I remember when I learned it the first time, I got rather confused. When it talks about pi being 3.0142 was partly discovered by, you'll tell me, was it Chinese people? I think said discovered pi, the Greeks.
Pythagoras was it all that, wasn't it?
Well, whatever. It was actually brought down in the Gemara in Baba Basra, place 25b. You can have a look at it in the English Gemaras in the Shul, when it talks about how you know that the circle, and it talks about if you square off a circle, you end up with four little points and the whole thing, and I can't, it gets very complicated, so I decided not to bother. But that is many years, well, now many years before the Greeks came up with this idea that all the circumference of a circle times all that stuff, and the Gemara brought it about many sort of years earlier. That's not, I mean, you know, the chokhmah of the Torah is emes, it's true, it's just, it's not a storybook. That's why when we talk about the Torah, we refer to the laws, the Gemaras and the Mishnahs. It's not a joke, it's not a storybook, it's not a book of science that it's very nice to study. It's a book to live by, it's a book to take our ideals, a book to as you said, I think the words you used, was it a method to show, was it you used, you said it was like a method to show them how to live. That's the idea of what the Torah is supposed to be. It's supposed to show us, in the same way as if you buy a washing machine, you would expect to read the instructions and to show you how to run them at all. To give an example, if you bought a computer, Henry, and you wanted to know how to work the computer, what would you do?
Phone up somebody.
You'd read the instructions. Exactly. You'd take advice.
That's the grandchild.
That's true. You would take advice, you'd follow the instructions, you'd see exactly what to do.
I wouldn't understand.
All right, you get the idea. You buy one of these pre-packed furniture packs from IKEA, of which I seem to have rather a lot of in my flat. You read the instructions, and you see, and you still end up with screws left over. But still, you would follow the instructions, and if you try and do it by yourself, you can end up going wrong. You know, you've got to follow the instructions, and that's the same idea with the Torah. The Torah, you're on this world to live. So how do you live? How am I supposed to live? We have the book, we have the Torah. You follow the instructions. If you don't follow the instructions, give again a couple of classic examples. Of, I wish I could give so many examples, but apparently the rates of ovarian cancer in Jewish women are more very, 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 very small. Very small. I did read, when again I was doing research and I'd forgotten the figures, certainly of Orthodox Jewish women, ovarian cancer is more or less unheard of. Why? This is not exactly a definite reason, but it was suggested. But because they keep the laws of Nidah, where we don't cohabitate during the menstrual cycle, that somehow is a protection. Not that I'm an expert on these things, but that one is said, it gives protection, and that's what sort of stops ovarian cancer. So you can see that by keeping the laws, keeping things, that one can have healthy benefits and all that sort of thing. Most of the big food outcries of recent years, BSC and all these other things, not affected kosher animals or the way that we purify, you know, we salt our food and the blood and that sort of thing. We can see how by keeping certain laws, many examples, and I'm sure you can think of many yourselves, that by keeping the laws of the Torah, keeping what's told, we can appreciate how they are better for us. Not that that's the reason why we do it. God told us to do it. We accept them. But that's why we understand, we keep them. And there's many examples where we can see the Torah is embraced, we can appreciate it, and we can understand that when we come to Shavuos, when we're supposed to rededicate ourselves to the Torah, and in fact, when you listen to the laning of the first day Shavuos, might not be very difficult in a shul like Southport, but now we laning, you're supposed to imagine you're standing there, because it's the same day that our Sinai took place, you're supposed to imagine there, maybe with me you'll be able to literally hear some of the noises of what it might have been like at the time of our Sinai. You're supposed to really bring it to life and imagine that you are there and rededicating yourself. That's the whole idea. Well, we read the I mean, there's so much more I can go on and talk about, but she's not here yet, but I think her refreshments are awaiting. I think your I think your refreshments are waiting, so I'll just leave it there.
Does Zohar come into it?
Into what?
Into all the.
Well, the Zohar talks more on the Kabbalistic side of things, more sort of.
Because doesn't that follow into Shavuot as well? But it sort of encompasses it in.
Well, there was lots of Kabbalistic things in Shavuot in the fact that the day of the Torah is not mentioned. That Shavuot has anything to do with the Torah. We know the Torah was given on Shavuot. How do we know? Very simple. It says that on the sixth day of the third month, they got the Torah. It says the third day, the beginning, the first day of the sixth of the third month, they came to Har Sinai. On the second day, they were warned for 3 days. 3 days, 5 days is five. The next day, it says they were given the Torah, is the sixth. We are also told that Shavuot is you count 50 days after the next day of Pesach, which ends up being the sixth of Sivan. So we know quite clearly that Shavuos is the time they got the Torah, but no link is mentioned in the Torah at all. And that also goes back to some of the ideas that there's no sort of beginning and an end. We don't sort of... Anyway, but that's a whole totally different topic. Perhaps we can talk about that in one of the sermons, if we get any time, or whenever, for another time. But he goes a lot, the Zohar goes a lot deeply into these sort of ideas, of Kabbalistic ideas and hidden things and that sort of thing.
Rabbi, you said that on Shabbos you were going to give us the answer about how do you determine midnight?
No, I didn't say I would give you the answer. I was waiting for you people to give an answer. I have still not found an answer.
I checked
on the internet many different flashy methods, but all of them only happened during the day. This Dr. Salt Cyril mentioned an idea that you could time how long it takes for candles to burn, and you can take the time, whatever. But that still doesn't answer how would they know the exact. So you might know that it's 3 hours, but how would you know that in 3 hours is midnight? Would you work it out?
By the stars on the horizon.
Do stars move? Does the moon move?
No, but the horizon moves.
No, so you can see daybright, because you can see when it starts to get light, but how do you know when it's midnight?
Do you want to put the question again, because there were some people that were...
Okay, it's a practical question, that was asked to me by somebody in Manchester. In Judaism, we have certain times of the day that have certain significances. Daybreak, midday, sunrise, sunset, all these things are very easy to work out. When it's daybreak, you can see it starts to get light. When it's sunrise, obviously we see the sun rising. When it's sunset, we see the sun setting. When it's nightfall, we see the stars, and we have it very easy. But midnight is a very important time in Judaism. Why? Korbanos, sacrifices, had to be stopped, eaten by midnight. The Korban Pesach, the Paschal lamb, had to be finished by Chatzos, midnight. After midnight, couldn't eat it, you had to burn it. The Shema, the evening Shema, has to be completed by Chatzos, midnight. Practically, in the olden days before watches, how did they know? How could they work out when midnight was? Practically, how did they do it? How did they work?
With the moon.
Don't ask
the moon is
I'm waiting for you to answer.
The moon is directly.
The moon is,
is it?
Directly above. The same as you get the sun directly above at midday, the moon is above.
Is that right?
Midnight? Yeah.
I think the candle idea is quite good.
Yeah, but you might be able to work out timing, but then how would you know when is midnight? You might know, well, this candle takes 3 hours.
You know a difference, but you don't know when you listen to
it. It's a practical question. It doesn't have any application nowadays.
What about next time? you could calibrate it.
How did they know when midnight was in the old days? Practical question. I've tried to research it on the internet with no luck.
Well, Lev, thank you very much indeed for coming along this evening. It's a great testimony to those, your disciples here in Southport. The more people have come to hear you tonight than came to the annual general meeting last Thursday night.
Oh, really? I should have been speaking then. That would have been a very long time.
We don't know whether it's you or the light refreshments that's brought everyone out. But we thank you very much for your time. We've thoroughly enjoyed it. We would like you, gentlemen, to particularly stay for Mincha. Mm. Will you be intention now, myself, to do Mincha?
And Mariv. I have already davened with
Mariv, then.
Right, okay.
Now,